Hi, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Max Planck Florida's Neurotransmissions Podcast. I'm Joe Schumacher, and today I'm hosting solo. Ben and Misha are missing in action, but I'm not alone. We have a great guest today who's working on a fascinating problem in neuroscience, and it's something about which I don't know very much, so I'll be learning as much as the folks at home. And just to put this neuroscience problem in its most basic terms, animals need energy to survive. None of our organs can function without energy. All of our cells use energy to move around, to grow, to general cell maintenance stuff. So staying healthy requires energy. And of course, we as animals use tremendous amounts of energy to do stuff at an organismal level. It's the reason people load up on carbohydrates before they run a marathon. So the simple picture of how animals work is energy in, stuff happens, energy expended, end of story, a cycle of that sort of thing. In reality, this story is vastly more complex. There's a lot of different systems involved, and a lot of things can go wrong that will disrupt energy homeostasis, resulting in things like obesity, diabetes, and many other disorders. And joining us to unravel the mysteries of energy homeostasis and metabolism is today's guest, Dr. Jens Bruning. He's a renowned neuroendocrinologist and geneticist who studies the role of the central nervous system in regulating energy and glucose metabolism. He's director of the Max Planck Institute for Metabolism Research in Cologne, Germany, and director at the Center for Endocrinology, Diabetes, and Preventative Medicine at the University Hospital in Cologne. So, Dr. Bruning, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for the opportunity.
So, I thought maybe a good place to start would be to try to elucidate the basic picture of what happens when I take in some energy. So, say I eat an apple or a mouse eats some mouse food. What is the normal healthy process that takes place there?
Well, the normal healthy process is that the food, you know, gets ingested. So it gets, you know, broken up into its constituents, and those will then be absorbed from the stomach and from the gut, and then the nutrients will reach the bloodstream. And from there, they can be provided to organs who need the energy sources, such as fat or carbohydrates or protein building blocks to generate mass that is needed to maintain organ function.
And so so it's broken down, like something like the blood glucose level will rise. And what are some of the systems that are in place to make sure that that energy is being absorbed properly?
What our work mostly focuses on the regulation of glucose metabolism, because it's an, you know, critical, quickly available energy source following food ingestion. And so in order to ensure that glucose is taken up by the relevant tissues, the body secretes in response to rising blood glucose concentrations a hormone which is called insulin. And insulin is released from specialized cells in the pancreas. And those cells have the machinery to sense the blood glucose concentration. So immediately as blood glucose concentrations rise, the pancreatic beta cells will release insulin into the bloodstream. And then insulin finds its receptor, the insulin receptor, on relevant target tissues such as skeletal muscle and fat. And then binding of insulin to the receptor promotes uptake of glucose from the bloodstream into those organs. And at the same time, insulin acts on insulin receptors expressed on liver cells. And the liver has a capacity to generate glucose itself under conditions of starvation. And so having ingested the food, rising glucose concentrations and rising insulin concentrations then suppress the new production of glucose from the liver. So insulin does everything after the meal to reduce blood glucose concentrations.
And if I understand correctly, it's not just that, you consume energy to have energy go into cells for cell function, but having elevated blood glucose levels is is unhealthy. There's bad things that happen.
Right. This is damaging. I mean, so basically the disease associated with chronically increased, unphysiologically high glucose concentrations is diabetes. And as a consequence of those chronically elevated glucose concentrations, there are a characteristic set of so-called diabetic complications. And those affect largely the tissues, which have very small vessels. And those get damaged as a consequence of the high glucose concentrations. And these are the vessels in the retina of the eye, in the kidney, and the small vessels which serve the nerve endings to provide them with oxygen and nutrients. And so as a consequence of chronically high glucose concentrations in diabetes, typically patients then develop a diabetic retinopathy, eye disease, kidney disease, and failure of those very fine nerve terminals, and thereby losing sensation in their feet, for example.
Right. And so insulin then is not just important for metabolism, but keeping people healthy just in general with eyesight.
Exactly.
And it's also, and central to your work is this this fact that insulin receptor is not just expressed throughout the body, but in the brain itself. So maybe describe a little bit about how your research in the central nervous system is finding out the role of insulin in regulating these types of things.
So what really caught our interest already some years ago was the fact, and that had been long known before, that the insulin receptor is not only expressed in this classical target tissues that everybody has studied, the ones I mentioned, muscle, fat, and liver, but there is a high level of insulin receptor expression, so the mediator of insulin action, in the central nervous system. And there's a particularly high level of expression in a very specific region of the brain, which we know controls metabolic homeostasis of the organism, and that's the so-called hypothalamus. And so this is why we got interested in trying to understand what insulin might do beyond its classical actions, if you want to call it like this, in those peripheral tissues, maybe also via its action through the central nervous system.
And when I saw your talk yesterday, one of the things that struck me as somebody who's interested in how neural circuits are put together, different cell types in the hypothalamus you're finding have different roles, not just in regulating metabolism, but also more complex behavior like feeding, like acquiring food. So what are some of the techniques that you've used to get at dissecting out who is doing what in the hypothalamus?
So basically, I find this a fascinating field of contemporary neuroscience, is really that we're getting now to the point that we can study very specific neuronal populations. So even a small region, a small anatomical region like the hypothalamus, harbors many different neuronal cell types. If you look under the microscope, they all look alike, more or less. But you can now, with molecular genetic tools, determine what proteins do specific neurons make, and thereby classify subtypes of neurons, and then ask specifically which subtype of neurons in a region gets activated, let's say, by insulin or by another hormone which regulates food intake, the so-called leptin. And by doing so, over the last, basically 10 years, we've come to demonstrate that it's a very specific subset of neurons in the hypothalamus which gets predominantly targeted by those hormones, insulin and leptin. And even more complicating matters is that insulin and leptin target two very specific neuronal subpopulations, among others, which have a functional antagonistic role. And so one very specific subpopulation expresses a neuropeptide, which is called pro-opiomelanocortin, or POMC. And once those neurons get activated, you suppress feeding. So this is why they're called anorexigenic neurons. And it's a very distinct number. It's about 3,000 neurons in mice and men. And right neighboring to those neurons, and again, you cannot tell them apart by just looking at the microscope without knowing the molecular signature of them, There is a functionally antagonistic population, which are called AGRP, agouti-related peptide-expressing neurons, which just do the opposite. If you activate those, you will drive the animal towards feeding. And so in an attempt of insulin, for example, to inhibit food intake, because it goes up when you have enough energy in your organism, insulin will activate those POMC neurons, which suppress feeding, and at the same time inhibit the neighboring neurons, which express AGRP and otherwise would drive you towards eating. So those signals then basically communicate to the CNS that enough energy is available in the organism, and then initiate a very specific response by targeting very specific neurons to exert a coordinate, you know, biological response.
So, yeah, so you mentioned these two sort of antagonistic types of cells, the POMC cells, that are, when they're active, they suppress feeding, right, and the AGRP cells enhance feeding. Is that associated with hunger or being satiated in general? Like, when I'm hungry, is it because of these hormone levels activating these different types of cells, like the cognitive aspect of hunger or whatever?
Well, the perception of hunger likely is also gated through those neurons. But one should really say that our understanding how the wiring into the brain, deeper into brain regions, is exactly structured, we're just beginning to understand right now. So basically, we're looking at a very basic, very old, we call it homeostatic system, which basically operates almost subconsciously. It's almost like a reflex-like reaction. Those neurons sense that there is enough energy, and then they, you know, elicit autonomic responses, which are not necessarily conscious decisions, right? So it's more of a very basic regulatory mechanism, which of course eventually can be also overruled by higher cognitive functions. And we all know that in principle, even if our body knows that we have enough energy, that we can overcome this.
Or satiety. I might even be hungry sometime and be like, well, I could stand to lose.
So in that sense, it's a very complex, I think it's due to the complexity of behavior and the brain, but I think it's a very nice entry point into the brain, having a very specific, very, let's say, basic regulatory system, which then gets tuned by other inputs. But this at least offers us an entry point, you know, to study to which other neurons do those neurons talk, how are they interconnected, how do they get modulated in their activity by other, let's say, higher brain centers. And this is exactly not only what our lab is doing, but the whole field is really trying to get into. And as you mentioned before, what are the technologies? I think there has been a revolution really in functional neuroscience, that we can now go in and first of all visualize those cells. We can determine what genes do they express, which proteins do they make, what are characteristic mediators of those cells, where do they project to, in other words, what are the brain regions targeted by those neurons. We can manipulate, remote control the activity, either by drugs or by light, and then exactly investigate, you know, how does the activity of those neurons impinge on, you know, a whole plethora of physiological responses and even higher brain functions.
And, one of the, on a sort of philosophical level, you were, in your talk, you had a diagram of this circuit where these antagonistic cell types have a sort of a common downstream target that, right, they have opposing effects on, that I guess is mediating this, am I going to feed or not, right, behavior. But the AGRP cells, not only do they they promote feeding.
Yes.
I get this backwards. They promote feeding by inhibiting this downstream neuron, but they also inhibit the POMC cells.
Exactly.
Is that right? So when you look at how this circuit is drawn out, the cells that are signaling you don't need to eat are being inhibited by the cells that say you do need to eat.
Right.
So there's this sort of bias in the circuit construction that is really geared towards feeding.
Exactly.
Like the overwhelming bias, I guess, with all things being equal, is that it looks like an animal with this circuit wants to eat food.
Right.
So I wonder, why that might be wired that way. Why isn't there sort of an equal balance of knowing when to eat and knowing when not to eat?
Well, I think the most sensitive explanation to that is an evolutionary one. If you go back, let's say, what was the evolutionary system on, what was the evolutionary pressure on the system to develop? It was really that animals, over thousands of years of evolution, were exposed to an environment where food was a limiting source, so to say.
It's scarce.
And so you're really, so the animal was running around most of the time hungry and in relative energy deficit. So it would make perfect sense in optimizing a neurocircuitry from an evolutionary point of view to ensure organismal fitness and the ability to reproduce and survive, to have a system in place in the brain which always ensures that as soon as you come across calories, that you efficiently, that you're motivated to eat them, take them up, and store them in terms of fat, for example, for times when no calories are available. And I think part of the current obesity epidemic, if you want to call it like this, is that we are an organism which over evolution has exactly been optimized under those circumstances, and now our environment has fundamentally changed, that we basically have unlimited food availability 24 hours, 7 days. And that, of course, this then hits a system which is optimized to ensure food intake and has a relatively weak counterpart which suppresses feeding, that this then suddenly turns against us because we have been selected in a different manner.
Right. So now that we have food everywhere, right, we're still wired to want to consume more food than we... Yeah, I think that's... It really sort of puts in perspective, like, our relationship with food. Like, it's gone beyond kind of a survival thing to something that we almost do just because we can, and it's enjoyable, and it actually makes me wonder, people talk in the field of addiction research about the behaviors that lead to drug use or like drug seeking behavior. Mm. Is there any kind of corollary there between our relationship with food and our relationship with addiction to drugs? I mean, is all food consumption geared towards homeostatic?
It's not. And what you're pointing out is a very interesting but also very complicated issue. So I wouldn't say it's a one-to-one relation to, let's say, drugs of addiction. However, what is known is, and I think each of us knows it, that there is a certain hedonic value associated to food. And there are certain foods which have a higher value and certain foods which have a lower value. And also that even makes sense from an evolutionary point of view, that if you consumed something that was rich in carbohydrates and rich in fat, meaning a very calorie-dense food, that it would make sense for an organism to experience this as a desirable food as compared to less energy-dense food. And so there is clearly the second aspect to it, that food can be rewarding, and there is, and we call this the hedonic component of feeding regulation, and this also seems to play a very, very important role in, well, it's dysregulation in obesity development. If you basically have a misguided, let's say, over rewarding annotation to food, that this, of course, will also drive you into trouble.
Yeah, so one thing that this work that you do with these AGRP neurons and, selectively identifying distinct populations of cells and their function in this feeding behavior is that, unlike, I think, a lot of circuit neuroscientists, systems neuroscientists, this work is really factoring in the organism kind of as a whole. There's multiple organ systems at play. You have the pancreas releasing insulin. You have the fat cells releasing leptin, and there's a third hormone, ghrelin, is the stomach released hormone, and all these things are regulating whether you're hungry or not. And one of the things that I found kind of spooky in your talk yesterday was not only are these cells in the hypothalamus regulating behavior, they're regulating insulin metabolism too, isn't that right?
Right, perfectly right. And so, again, it makes perfect sense because basically what those neurons are, they're ideally positioned as energy sensing neurons. So they're in the privileged position by responding to insulin, leptin, but not only to those hormones. They can also immediately respond to nutrient components themselves. So they're like glucose-sensitive subtypes of those neurons, which immediately respond to changes in glucose basically directly, even independent of insulin. And so you have highly specialized neurons which very well integrate a whole array of information about how much and what kind of energy is available in your body. And then I think in my view, it makes perfect sense that those neurons will not only control how much more energy you will take up from outside of your body, but also how you partition energy sources across your body. Let's say how much glucose do I want to take up to fat in order to convert it into fat? How much glucose do I want to produce newly in liver? And I find what I find most fascinating about those cells is that they then, of course, serve the purpose to coordinately regulate whole body physiology in accordance to the energy state of the organism. And this is the way we look at them. It's more like an integrated physiological control than just the isolated decision, am I going to eat or not? And it then makes, of course, sense if you have no energy available that you will try to take up energy from outside, but at the same time you want to activate your liver to make glucose itself, and vice versa. If you have enough energy, you stop eating, and then you want to shut off at the same time glucose production in liver. And this is basically what we're studying there, and putting them then center stage in whole body physiology.
And so one of the whole body physiological modulations that can take place is insulin resistance.
Right.
What is known about the link there between the brain and controlling how, say, fat cells are going to take up glucose, or muscle cells are going to take up glucose? Right. Like, how is that?
That is not completely understood either. So we have shown for one specific tissue how the brain controls glucose uptake. And this is a highly specialized organ, which is called brown adipose tissue. It's not the classical fat-storing adipose tissue. You find it basically in the neck and between the shoulder blades, and particularly in neonates. And this fat cell, the brown fat cell, is characterized by a high content of so-called mitochondria, so which generate usually the energy in a cell. But those cells can convert energy into heat. And so it's a highly metabolically active tissue. And what we could show, if you drive the activity of AGP neurons, you control sympathetic nerve activity going to this brown adipose tissue and thereby modulate its activity. So we kind of have a good feeling, at least for this tissue, also what the output side, coming from the brain back to the tissue, looks like. And so this seems to be controlled by the regulation of sympathetic nerve activity, release of the sympathetic nerve transmitter norepinephrine, and that then the driving AGP neurons leads to less release of norepinephrine and thereby down-tunes the activity of that tissue. And that, of course, also, again, makes sense. If you put it all back together, AGP neurons are activated when you have no food or little food. And, of course, then you want to down-tune the activity of a tissue, which will just burn energy as heat. And so I think it all makes sense in the physiological, from a physiological point of view, that under a state of hunger, you want to limit the activity of an organ which otherwise would burn off further your calories as heat.
So then the brown adipose tissue in these types of experiments is kind of like a model of how other forms of tissue would be regulated?
Yes. I mean, most likely the output function of the brain is autonomic innervation, which can be either sympathetic or parasympathetic. And the exact way, for example, how those neurons control liver function is not fully ruled out. What is exactly the mechanism? What is released? What then acts on the liver cell to modulate it? But this is exactly what we're trying to figure out over upcoming experiments.
So I wonder if we could take sort of a human side picture of this thing. And you mentioned the obesity epidemic. Are there genetic components to determining if somebody's going to have an energy homeostasis problem that's related to this sort of hypothalamic circuit type stuff?
Well, there are basically two ways you can look at human genetics of obesity. I think one way to study it is to look for rare mutations. So what geneticists under those circumstances do is they try to identify subjects which have a very extreme phenotype and which provide evidence for inheritance of it. Let's say you have a family where all of the members, or many of the members, became very obese at young age. So it really points towards a genetic disease. You know, you have inheritance within the family, and you have a very pronounced phenotype. And this way of doing genetics, you can really try to prove, I mean, what are really fundamentally important components controlling a given phenotype, such as obesity. And there's a colleague at the University of Cambridge in England, Steve O'Reilly, with the co-worker Sadaf Farooqi, and they have very systematically collected over the last, let's say 20 years, exactly those types of families where kids very early on developed excessive obesity. And now, with modern genetic tools, you can go back and ask the question, what are the mutations in those subjects? And interestingly enough, they find exactly the components we are looking at, like the leptin receptor, leptin itself, or characteristic transcription factors which make those very specific neurons, which become either AGP neurons, POMC neurons, or downstream neurons, they find them affected in those families. And so what this really tells you is almost the best kind of proof of concept experiment that the whole system similarly operates in humans. And that, of course, is very reassuring when we're trying to study mice as a model system, if we find that a kind of validation from human genetics.
And we're just about out of time, actually. But one of the things that, you know, I was actually only found out about this morning when I was sort of reading about what is diabetes. Mm-hmm. But it seems that one of the physiological characteristics, at least of type 2 diabetes, mm-hmm. is that there's a buildup of like amyloid protein in the pancreas. And you said, is that not true?
Well, it's true. Yeah, there's data for this, yes.
Well, what it reminded me of was that this is what seems to take place in the brain.
Right.
Like this same sort of protein aggregate type stuff in neurodegenerative disorders. And I happen to see on your website that you're also studying neurodegeneration type conditions. Is there a link between diabetes and neurodegeneration, or is your spin on how to study neurodegeneration completely separate from this?
No, it exactly arises from this idea. And so one should say that it's not that straightforward, but if you go to the literature, there is lots of data indicating from epidemiological studies that subjects which suffer from diabetes have a higher risk to develop neurodegenerative disorders such as Alzheimer's disease. And that, of course, you really don't know what's the cause and the consequence in mm-hmm. this type of study. I mean, you just find evidence for an increased risk. And one should also point out there are other studies which do not come to that very same conclusion. But there is a lot of discussion about the possibility that diabetes is associated with an increased risk of neurodegenerative disorders. So now knowing that insulin can act in the brain, it is, of course, then tempting to speculate that maybe altered insulin action, as observed in peripheral organs or in the hypothalamus of diabetic subjects, may then also contribute to the development of classical pathologies seen in Alzheimer's disease, such as protein aggregation and neurodegeneration. And this is why we started studying this. This is clearly not the main focus of our lab, but there are many, many other labs investigating this link. There are even clinical trials now sponsored by the NIH where the idea is that in brains of Alzheimer's disease-affected patients, insulin doesn't act appropriately anymore. And so the idea is then to give intranasal insulin, which can go to the CNS.
So it crosses the blood-brain
barrier. It crosses the blood-brain barrier across the olfactory system, basically. And so it can then increase, specifically in the brain, insulin concentrations in an attempt to restore normal insulin action, which has been described as being attenuated in Alzheimer's disease. So these are even clinical trials. But I think the final mechanistic insights, I think we have not really at hand. So it could be also other mechanisms which maybe promote insulin resistance and Alzheimer's disease. For example, many people have been demonstrating that an increase in inflammation can cause insulin resistance on one hand, and it can at the same time also in the brain promote neurodegeneration. So inflammation is an important component on the progression of Alzheimer's disease. So now you could also speculate that if inflammation is activated in a subject in the brain, it could manifest as diabetes or neurodegeneration. So not really saying that the causal link between both is the impaired insulin action leading to neurodegeneration, but it could be just another common root factor, which then leads to the manifestation of both diseases and then really doesn't link them in a directly causal manner.
Wow, that's really cool. I mean, I think we have a lot of listeners that are going to grad school or transitioning to postdocs and stuff, and they often write about, wanting to find cool circuits to, find complex, relationships with behavior and stuff. I think this is a perfect example. I mean, you have a lot of moving parts, a lot of hormone regulation, all this sort of thing. I mean, it's incredibly fascinating. And thanks for joining me today. This was great.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Yeah, take care. Okay, and that's our show. Thanks to Dr. Bruning for sitting down with us while he was in town. It was a really fascinating conversation. Be sure to let us know what you think. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Subscribe on iTunes or Google Play or whatever. Thank you to our producers in the Office of Scientific Communication at MPFI. And we'll talk to you again soon. Bye.